This episode is brought to you by Sterling Soap Company. How often do you think about your soap? Well, if you answered, not much, maybe you should. You see, a lot of what passes for soap in stores is technically not soap, according to the FDA's definition. It's full of lab-created chemicals and detergents because, well, it's cheaper to make. Now, what if you could buy natural soap made from natural ingredients like tallow, palm oil, coconut oil, and scented with essential oils, and for just a little more than you'd pay for grocery store soap? Sterling soap is 100% natural, and with a wide variety of bath soaps, shave soaps, beard balm, lotions, and cologne, there's a product and a scent for just about everybody. Check them out for yourself at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLING soap.com.
Looking for the perfect gift for that basketball fan in your life? Well, I've got a book for you. It's called Basketball Now. Newly updated for 2025, it spotlights 50 of the NBA's top stars. Think fast breaks, clutch threes, and buzzer beaters. Captured in stunning photography with sharp, readable analysis. From rising stars to veteran icons, this book is a courtside pass to the game right now. Wrap up a slam dunk this holiday season and pick up your copy of Basketball Now today at your favorite bookseller.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory. 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and Memorabilia, the Sports History Network, in conjunction with Swick Enterprises, and we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home, Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. At this time, I'd like to introduce my co-host, the senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, but also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Hartman. He hails Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Captain, always good to be here, sir. Great to see you.
Great seeing you, Joe. And we started off at the time of our recording here. We just have almost finished a complete five-day weekend of professional NFL football on many different networks that you must subscribe to.
Many different networks you need a subscription to for each one. We're getting there, aren't we?
We're almost at the beauty of pay-per-view of every game, of every season, of every week, of any every NFL team. But anyways, I don't want to be a downer on the season. We've had some very good games this past
week. It's just week one, Bob. It's just week one.
And I'm pleased with the Packers. I got a lot of texts throughout the game. I said I'm going to try to get my Super Bowl tickets now after that performance, which I saw a defense that I haven't seen in years in Green Bay. And I saw an offense that was pretty powerful. And I saw a Detroit Lions team that seemed to be completely disorientated in the field. So,
considering how deep in the playoffs Detroit went last year, they were pretty manhandled by the Packers.
Right. And the way I look at it, a lot of the gambling that they're doing, they continue to do, may not pay off over 17, 18, whatever, how many games season it is now. And what I found very interesting was how out of sync their offensive line was. I know they had a couple of new people on the line, but man.
That's what preseason's for. That's what practice and preseason is for.
Exactly. I just couldn't believe what I saw there. And I got a feeling the Parsons number one issue for the Packers kind of must have scared some of the Lions boys. with regards to what he could do. And he's a pretty aggressive player, and he's a real so that addition, I think, psyched everybody up on the defense to play a little harder, which is nice.
Well, at the old Squire's house, what me and my son Xander were talking about mostly was the Patrick Mahomes hit on the San Diego Chargers defensive back. So Mahomes running out of bounds, trotting out of bounds, defensive back, you know, pulls up to let him go. Is that my echo?
Not mine.
Defensive back pulls up a little bit, and Patrick Mahomes puts a hat on him as he's going out of bounds, knocks him out of his...
And
if a defensive back did that to Mahomes,
aggressive. He'd be out. Aggressive, to say the least. It's very interesting. But in any event, I'm going to hand off to you. I know you've been following some very interesting auctions.
Let's get into it. Golden Auctions ended a couple days ago. I don't know who's, you know, it can't be me. Hang on a second. I don't usually have feedback, do I? That's weird. I'll turn it over to our producer to fix it. Gold, I don't know who consigns this stuff to Golden, but they've been landing amazing stuff. Well, they, one of the things that I like to track more out of curiosity than anything. It is me, isn't it? Is the 2000 playoff contender. Hang on a second. There, maybe that fixes it. No, it did not. Okay. I beg your pardon. I'm going to forge through. The 2000 playoff contender, number 144, Tom Brady championship ticket with autograph. And that's the numbered 1 to 100, the 2000 playoff contender with the gold championship ticket that hangs on the right of it.
Okay.
Tom Brady's scribble of an autograph at the bottom. We've tracked these before. This one was a PSA 8 with the autograph not graded. So it went in Golden for $500. What was it? It just had it with the VIG. $549,000. It was $450 plus 20%. So went for $550,000. You're like, that's a hell of a lot of money for a Tom Brady card. But we've seen this card go for $1.8 to $2 million. At one point, it was the most expensive football card ever sold. You know, well over any vintage stuff that we collect. So, to be honest, that 540, like we were talking about in pre-show, is probably about a 60, 70% haircut from what we've seen this get.
Right.
So, I mean, four or five years ago, this was a $1.3, $1.4 million card.
So, what does that tell us for the market? Is it telling us that we have an enormous amount of, and I hate to say it, flippers who are, you know, with their phone, with their comps, seriously negotiating with any type of dealer, will not take any type of logical argument when it comes to buying or selling a card, other than, well, this is what the comp tells me, and I got to get it at 25% less than the comp because I got to get 25% on the card when I buy it. And I'm a dealer, and you're not, even though you're behind the table at the show selling the card to me for the 25% less than what you want. No, and I'm being sarcastic when I say it, but really believe strongly that the flipper mentality of the new style dealers that are in the market today is a bubble waiting to explode badly. And I really mean badly. I emphasize the word badly because they just really don't have a conceptualization of what they are trying to do with a card just to just chronically turn over the card over and over again, eliminating any thoughts or any concepts of collecting anything. So we've got a little bit disconnect going on right now. And again, you know, everybody know, anybody who's watched this podcast or listened to me knows where I stand on this stuff. And I'm going to get, you know, tough on this, on what I'm saying with regards to it, because it really irritates me to see we're really we're really hurting the hobby right now. Not us, not you or I, but the flipping crowd is really hurting the hobby right now.
This card reminds me of Bitcoin.
Yeah. You know,
people who invest in Bitcoin are like, well, the value is what somebody's willing to pay for.
Right.
It doesn't have a PE. It doesn't produce anything. It doesn't make anything. So here's this card. The only reason it's worth so much is it's Tom Brady and it's numbered 1 to 100. Well, at some point, there's not 100 people willing to spend $1.5 million on this card.
Exactly.
There might be 4 or 5, and we've seen the market get saturated with those people who are willing to do it or to speculate on it. You were joking before the show where you're like, looks like somebody, you know, bet on the cum in the craps table and lost. Whoever bought that, or you know, whoever bought it to flip it, maybe lost money, or who knows? I haven't checked this. I have probably about 15 of these. I track on a Google Doc of because they're numbered on the back. This one was number 44, I believe, number 48. So I track them. You know what their grade is, what their auto is, if it's graded, and then what they went for and when. So it's pretty interesting to see how some of these have gone downhill. Let me give a couple of examples.
What's interesting, I'm on a couple of different chat boards, not just
the
community, but on another chat board that I'm on, there's been some running commentary with regards to how, you know, collectors like ourselves feel about the new market of dealers who are the flippers, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And somebody brought up a good point. If you go back years ago, what did we used to have to go by? We had a price guide. Okay, we had a big Beckett price guide. We had a magazine. We had a couple of different monthly price guides that we could follow. Beckett, Sports Collectors Digest, a few other ones. Okay, so we had a base. So let's just look at it very simplistically. At that time, there were not that many cards in the hundreds of dollars of range. They were the true superstars. Okay, I'm talking about the 1980s and early 90s before the explosions. So, okay, if a card is $100 in a price guide, I put it out on my table for $100. A guy comes over and says, "Hey, can you do $70 for that card, let's say?" And I say, "Okay, how about if we meet halfway? Well, give me 85. He'll counter with 80. I'll usually say,
"Okay, 80,
blah blah blah." So today now, let's look at a situation where we got a card, let's say, is worth $2,000 on a dealer's table. That's what the comp is saying. That new person now on the opposite side of the table wanting to buy that card say, "Hey, you're really high on that card. I'll give you $1,500 for
it." Yep.
The dealer says, "Okay, I'm high on the card, but the comp is saying it's $2,000. So how am I high on the card?" And then you get into the argument, "Well, I need some room to work on this card. I got to flip this card."
And really, you should be agnostic to if the person's trying to make margin.
Yeah.
Because if the next person comes along and they're a collector, they don't need that 25 basis points.
Right. So now the dealer is the psychiatrist behind the counter. Because now I got to listen to your problem, not yours, but you know the person trying to buy it, and say, "Okay, I can't afford it." Well, don't buy it. What do you want me to do about it? You know what I mean? So,
I don't know, but to see, I just looked. This number 48 card has never appeared in auction,
okay.
But the last one that sold was a PSA 7, and it sold for about $540. So this is a PSA 8, so about the same. So you went from 2.3 million to that. Oh yeah.
Wow.
I'm sorry. My feedback.
It's truly amazing to see what's going on in the market, and it's really driving me crazy because again, I've been subjected to at a small show in Wilmington, I got some dealers saying, "Hey, what can you do on this stuff?" And I tell them, "Well, what do you want to do with this stuff? What do you want me to say? I'm at, you know, a book value. I know you need to get it graded because that's the only thing you understand. But you don't understand that there's collectability to, for, and I always use the example, I had some Burke Ross football cards that nobody ever saw before. They want him, blah, blah, blah. And I've got to fight with them about it, so on and so forth. And I'm just saying, hey, you know, this is not what the hobby is about. It's not a hobby. You know, it's a flipper. You know, it's a flipper.
Yeah. I've been witnesses too, where people come up and, oh, you have that list for 1,000 PSA. The PSA price guide said this, which was a joke for a long time, as it was very slow to recover to, you know, to nuances in the pricing. And then you got, well, VCP, vintage card price, says this. But VCP also has a couple of glaring holes where, you know, it didn't, you know, didn't catch bins. It didn't catch off center or lower quality, you know, cards, you know, et cetera. I don't know. It's just whatever it is. I don't know. It's tough.
Yeah.
You and I are not in the bark market to buy those Brady cards. So,
right. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, I see a long slog ahead until the bubble hits, and then the bubble hits. I think maybe things will calm down in the market. The collecting aspect will come back. Yep. Vintage will be more rational than what it is today. You know, give me any vintage you got so I can get it graded immediately, because that's what it's all about. Because that's all I understand. I only understand graded cards. I don't understand what you're trying to do with an ungraded, you know, for example, 67 Philadelphia set. You're trying to sell it. I'm just more concerned about what I can get out of it, how many tens I can get out, how many nines. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, that's not our hobby.
I'd also mentioned pre-show that Heritage went off about 4 or 5 days ago, and in there was Dan Fouts selling a lot of his personal collection off, which is really cool. They had a really cool video of Dan Fouts at his house in Eastern Oregon, talking about the collection and how he chose Heritage, which was a little funny. But the number one item was a 1977 Dan Fouts game-worn and autographed jersey matched to December 11th versus Broncos. That ended up going for $30,500.
Wow.
But a helmet from the season also went for $10,600. And then he had a bunch of really cool historic photos, or footballs. Like, for example, here's a football that I threw to Charlie Joyner for my 20,000th yard on Monday Night Football, where we beat the Raiders, you know. And it was really cool. And those went for, you know, about 3,000 to 4,000 each.
Wow.
I ended up winning the cheapest thing out there, which was a Chargers 40th reunion jersey from the Dan Fouts collection. I wanted something from the Dan Fouts collection.
Cool.
And just as the pricing started to go up, I started picking the lowest item thing.
I get it. I fully understand it, you know.
But some pretty cool thing. 40,000 yard football, you know, thrown to Kellen Winslow. There were some really cool footballs that were pretty historic. So I called it jokingly the Dan Fouts needs a new swimming pool auction, but who knows?
So. He's probably also, you know, realistic about if he can't hand the stuff down to somebody or whatever,
totally.
Get the money and get everybody all set. And, you know, God forbid anything happens, everybody's set and there's no stress about trying to liquidate the collection. So,
yeah,
I've heard it many, many times over the years from collectors and from players. So it is what it is. All right. Our special guest is here. We're going to introduce him and we're going to get into our show tonight. He's a good friend of our podcast. So he was last was a guest on our podcast in June 2024. He is a member of the Pro Football Writers of America. He's the author of 5 incredible pro football books. He also edits a great page on Facebook called the NFL in the 1970s, and he hails from Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Our good friend, Mr. Joe Zagorski. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Hey, Bob. Hey, Joe. How's it going? Thanks for having me on again. Well, I don't hail from Oak Ridge, but I live there now. I'm originally from Pottstown, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And my new book on former Dolphin offensive lineman Larry Little, it's actually my 6th book, and it comes out on October 7th.
Okay. All right. So yeah. I'm going to be rephrasing that and say author of 6 books
instead
of 5. And I do have my O.J. Simpson book here. I'll show you, which was very, very eloquently signed by, with a nice inscription by Joe. I appreciate that. I truly appreciate taking the time out and sending something like that for my autographed book collection.
No worries. I'll be sending you a copy of the Larry Little book too, as soon as it gets published next month. So
great. I look forward to reading that.
You'll get that coveted Gridiron Great bump in sales, Joe. Once the captain reviews the books, kids come up.
Between the podcast and the review coming up, Joe, you'll get a few more extra copies sold, hopefully. So.
Well, yeah, and you know the thing is, though, this is a different type of book because all the proceeds are actually going to be going to Mr. Little.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah.
He's going to, he's in his, I guess, almost late 70s now. And a lot of those guys, they live paycheck to paycheck like we do. So, I want to help out.
I looked it up, Joe. He'll be 80 in November.
Wow. So, which is pretty old compared to me. I'm only 62, but I'm catching up to him.
You got a few more years, Joe.
Yeah.
I got more than both of you guys, so. Hey, Joe, let's start off, if you could recap to our audience again. How'd you get started about writing football?
Well, many years ago, I used to write for a couple of small-town Pennsylvania newspapers. And, of course, they put me on sports, and I love sports. I grew up watching pro football. And after, I guess several decades after the 70s was over, I just hearkened back to that time when I just enjoyed it so much. I didn't see too many books specifically about the 1970s. So I thought, why don't I try and write one? Found a publisher who was interested in it. It was McFarland and Company. And I wrote it and they published it. And I thought, well, this isn't so bad. I'm getting paid $4 for each copy sold. So I'll be able to afford a Happy Meal. But I enjoyed the fact that a lot of people besides me were interested in that decade as well. So it went on from there, and I started trying to find different topics that I wanted to write about that had something about the 1970s. And I tried to focus on stuff that nobody had ever written about. You mentioned this three Buffalo Bills book. I didn't think that anybody ever wrote a book about the 73 Bills. And so I decided to write one on them. And so that's what's happened. Now we're up at book number 6 with the Larry Little book. Hopefully after that book is over, I'll eventually get finished with the book on the Hail Mary pass.
Okay, great, great.
You mentioned that pre-show. I guess the Steve Largent book is getting bumped.
Yeah,
that's okay. Hey, Joe, the book's name is From the Outhouse to the Penthouse, The Football Journey of Hall of Famer Larry Little. I know Larry was born in Georgia in 1945. I assume the outhouse is a reference to that he grew up without any indoor plumbing.
That's correct.
Tell us about the book.
That's correct. He didn't spend a lot of time there in Georgia, though. His family moved to Miami shortly after he was born.
Oh.
And he did come up with the title himself. He wanted the outhouse to be, in the title.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. He had a tough life when he was young. But a lot of kids then, especially minority kids, in the Miami area. He was one of 7 kids, and he his family, his father was an alcoholic, and his mother worked her butt off, basically. Eventually, he got a chance to go to Bethune-Cookman University. No major college was really paying him any mind when he was a high school senior. But Bethune-Cookman liked the fact that he could run fast, And for a lineman, he was very, very fast. So they offered him a scholarship, and he took it, you know. And he did really well for Boone Crookman. In fact, he made a lot of all-league teams on the defensive line. He wasn't an offensive lineman yet. But he still didn't give a lot of attention in the pros. No NFL team drafted him. No AFL team drafted him. But he did sign a free agent contract with the San Diego Chargers. And back at that time, they didn't call them practice squads. They called them taxi squads, you guys know. And he signed on for them as a taxi squad member. I think it was for like around $10,000 a year or something like that. Wasn't much. And after about 4 weeks, though, he was graduated up to the regular roster. And from then on, he never looked back. He played 2 years in San Diego, and then he was traded to the Dolphins. Kind of a unique way how he got traded to the – well, before he got traded to the Dolphins, he was – one day he felt like he was going to quit the game. He didn't think he was doing well enough in San Diego to stay there. And at that time, his position coach was Bum Phillips. You remember Bum from the Houston Oilers days. Well,
at
the time, Bum was a San Diego assistant coach. And he told Bum Phillips that he was going to quit. Well, Bum runs over to Sid Gilman, who was the head coach of the Chargers at that time. He goes, Sid, Larry Little is thinking about quitting. And Sid runs over to Larry and he goes, if I hear any more talk about you quitting, I'm going to splice your neck up. and that actually, that comment from Sid Gilman gave Larry Little the inspiration that he needed to stay with it. Of course, like I said, he didn't make the full-time roster, but he did make the practice squad. And then 4 weeks later into the regular season, he was advanced into the regular roster, and he did really well. How he got traded to Miami was kind of unique, too.
Yeah, I was curious about that.
He was going in to get his car worked on at this, I guess it was a Ford dealership in Miami one day, because he's from Miami, or well, originally he lived most of his childhood in Miami. And unbeknownst to him, a Dolphins player was getting his car worked on. And that person's name was Larry Zonka.
Oh, nice.
Well, they didn't know each other, but Larry Little was walking in and Larry Zonka was walking out. And they both crashed into the door together. And so eventually they opened the door. And the first words out of Zonka's mouth is, because he saw how big Larry Little was, he goes, who do you play for? Larry Zonka automatically assumed, hey, this guy's a pro football player. And Larry Little said, I play for San Diego. And he goes, wouldn't you rather play here in Miami? And he goes, yeah, I would. So Larry Zonka drives on over to the Dolphins facility on Biscayne Boulevard.
No kidding.
And he goes up, I guess it was like to the seventh floor where the Dolphins offices were. And he didn't have an appointment to see their general manager, Joe Thomas. And the secretary tried to stop him. And he had some choice words for her. And he walked in and unannounced. And he told Joe Thomas, you need to sign Larry Little. Well, this story is incredible because Joe Thomas at that time was working on a trade to get Larry Little. Isn't that funny how life works out for the best?
Wow.
Anyway, Joe Thomas was trying to fight Larry Zonka on saying, well, you know what? We're still a few thousand dollars away from and Larry Zonka said, Joe, I have a signing bonus that I haven't used. Use that and get Larry Little here.
You're kidding me.
No. And Joe Thomas says, well, we'll think about it. And Larry Zonka said, look, Joe, we're on the seventh floor. If you don't want to land on the first floor really quick, Joel and Larry Little.
So you had not only a song that story. Did that come from Larry Little or was that Zonka?
That was Zonka that told me that story.
Think about that now. I mean, because you get quarterbacks with salary caps. You get quarterbacks, you know, who take 20% of the salary cap and, you know, and kind of shrug their shoulders because they can't sign anyone around them. So here's Larry Zonka saying, I'll give up a signing bonus to bring in a good guard.
Yeah. And it worked really well because Larry Little, as you know, he's a Hall of Famer just like Larry Zonka is. He did really well for the Dolphins. He didn't do really well for them when it came to completing the 2-mile run around the track. That was a little tough for him. But he was really fast when it came to leading sweeps on the outside. In fact, he was as fast as Mercury Morris, the Dolphin halfback.
Wow.
In fact, one time I noted in the book, after I interviewed Mercury to confirm Larry Little's story, Larry Little was running, pulling so quickly that Mercury grabbed into the seat of the trousers of Larry Little to slow him down. And Larry Little, during the play, is yelling, "Get your blankety blank hands out of my pants!" You know. That's a true story. And so they did really well, of course, as you know.
Damn right. Pair of Super Bowls, including undefeated season. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's an entertaining book, but it's an eye-opening book. There's a lot of things in there I didn't realize. Larry Little grew up in an age back at that time where in Miami as a kid, he had to drink in, you know, segregated water fountains. You know, sitting on the back of the bus, the whole thing. And a lot of, you know, terrible things happened to him. His brother was murdered. I don't want to go into it in the story, you know, in the show here, but he says it, he talks about it in the book. And so there was a lot of interesting things that he told me that I had no idea about that he had experiences with. But one thing I did write a lot about him and Coach Shula, Don Shula, and when Don Shula got hired with the Dolphins in 1970, Larry Little had already been with the Dolphins for 1 year, so he figures I want to introduce myself to Don Shula. So at Don Shula's press conference to announce his signing as the new Dolphins head coach, after the conference is over, he goes up to Coach Shula and he says, "Hi, Mr. Shula. My name is Larry Little. I'm your offensive guard." And the first thing out of Shula's mouth is, "How much do you weigh?" And Larry Little was honest and he said, "I weigh 285. And Don Shula just turned around and walked away from him, didn't say another word.
Wow.
And so that sent the message to Larry Little, "I got to lose weight."
Okay. And so, I was curious.
Yeah, he did lose weight. Now, you got to remember, in 1970, there was a small NFL player strike at the beginning of training camp.
Lasted
a couple weeks. And so that set Don Shula back 2 weeks. Oh, I got to get this is my brand new team. I got to work their butts off. So Don Shula decides to schedule an unheard of 4-a-day practices.
Oh, shit.
You heard of 2-a-days. You might have heard of 3-a-days.
Yeah.
Don Shula had 4-a-day practices with this.
Not just sleep in the locker room.
And to make matters even worse, at that time, he was a proponent in believing that taking water breaks would cause players to cramp up. So you weren't even allowed to have water breaks.
Wow, that's funny.
Well, one day Larry Little had enough of that. So he told his roommate, "Tomorrow, I'm going to pretend to pass out." And so that's what he did. He pretended to pass out. So they take Larry Little, they carry him in, and they put him in the back of a station wagon, and they drive him to the locker room from the playing field, from the practice field. They get him into the training room. They put him on this table and they pack his body in ice in an air-conditioned training room. After about 5 minutes of this, Larry Little's throwing the ice off of him and go, oh my God, you know, whatever. So he goes crazy thinking, you know, what am I going to do now? So the team doctor looks at him, gives him a physical. You look pretty good to me. He goes, well, I can't be that good. I got to come up with an excuse for, you know, Coach Shula. So another doctor looks at him, and you're the healthiest guy we've ever seen here. So he's getting desperate. So they bring in somebody else, some other
doctor. I don't want to go back to practice.
they bring in somebody else. And he goes, you look pretty healthy, but you might have like a sinus condition. And Larry Little screams to him, well, put that down on the record. Put that down on the record.
Wow.
So
I love stuff like that.
That funny story's in the book too. So.
Wow. That's crazy to go 4 days and don't drink water. I don't know how
many. Incredible.
Half the team didn't pass out on the field anyways, especially in Miami during the summer and the heat.
Yeah, no kidding. Good point.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and when there were some players, you remember them, like J.B. Kane of St. Louis, Corey Stringer, Minnesota. Yep. They had heat. What do they call it? Heat prostration.
Heat exhaustion. Yeah.
Well, you know, big linemen wearing all those pads and stuff. It wasn't until somebody died that I think the NFL started saying no. You know. The risk of getting cramps is a lot less than the risk of dying.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, with the advent of, like, Gatorade and Powerade and those types of drinks, that's what you need when you're out there because you're sweating so much.
Exactly.
And, you know, to regenerate your system with, a quarter Gatorade in between practices, that should not have been unheard of. And I think that's where they started to realize, like Joe said, we got to really watch. We can't afford people to die on the field, which is crazy.
Yeah, and you know, after that happened, after that 70 season, Coach Shula didn't run 4-a-day practices anymore. He started whittling them down little by little because he knew the guys that, you know, they performed for him to get him to the playoffs and to the Super Bowl. He didn't need to kill them.
Right.
He just needed to slim them up a little bit.
Yeah.
I never could understand that mentality coaching. I mean, I could still remember in high school, you know, you would have these ridiculous practices, and I have no clue what are you attempting to do? You toughening up people, okay, yeah, but it's 100 degrees outside, and you're ready to pass out, and how are you gonna keep playing like that? And you're not gonna do that on a rainy day in November when it's 30 degrees with the wind chill out there. That makes sense. Joe, I got a question for you. You know, you've written, this is your sixth book. You know, each book is different, and we've talked about this in the past, and this is what I always find fascinating with a writer. Each book is different. Each book is unique, so on and so forth. How does this book set your thought or how was this book prepared differently than your other books? Can you compare it to something? Give us some feedback. Give our audience some feedback about the concept.
I think this book on Larry Little is different in that I dealt with Larry quite a bit. I interviewed him over a dozen times, and he also opened the door for me to interview a lot of Hall of Famers. I interviewed Joe Green because of this, Bob Greasy, Larry Zonka, you know, Mercury Morris, Norm Evans, you know, a lot of famous players. And I didn't really have that opportunity with really many of the other books. So it was an opportunity for me that I was really happy to get because of all the credibility with Hall of Fame players, especially like when I interviewed Joe Green. I didn't realize that Larry Little had his number so many times. He was Joe Green is one of the greatest defensive linemen in the history of the game. And for Larry Little to be able to win so many battles against him,
yeah,
to the point where the Steelers decided to avoid getting blocked by Larry Little, you know, it was eye-opening. I also think that, well, this book is different because I'm dealing with a different publisher. This is from Indigo River Publishing down in Florida. Okay. So with every publisher that you get, they can always be different. And so that's what made this one a lot different. And, you know, unfortunately, like the 73 Buffalo Bill book, this one took a long time for the publishers to get on the same page with both myself and Mr. Little. We revised it, I think, 4 or 5 different times.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a lot. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that Larry Little's a perfectionist, and he learned that from his assistant coach, Monty Clark, in Miami. He was a perfectionist to the point where you had to step exactly where he wanted you to step when you were with your blocking technique and stuff like that. And that gave me into it. Okay, now I know why Monty Clark was a perfectionist. Larry Little's a perfectionist too. So,
right. And I think to a certain degree, every era in football is different. The 70s are different than the 60s, than the 80s, than the 90s, than now the 20s. So we're in the 20s now, and we see, so many different coaches and so many different choreographed games to the step-by-step play that has to occur. So there's very little spontaneity. But if we go back to the 60s, the 70s, 80s, to a large degree, you had a lot more spontaneity. And you also had players that had, in my opinion, a lot of knowledge of what to do. If A happens, I'm going to respond with B.
Yeah.
B happens, I'm going to respond to C. Whereas today, you see players, and I'll use the example of the Packers-Lions game.
The of course.
Offensive line could not respond seeing different defenses coming at them. They didn't know what to do. So they're trying to figure out what to do with the guy they're trying to defend. At the same time, they got 3 other guys coming at their quarterback, so they don't know what to do. They're not told, they're not taught that. So that's a good point, Joe, that you bring up as far as, he was step by step. He knew what he had to do, and he did it.
And yet it was still simple. Larry Little told me that, you know, there was a basic signal that they gave out when they got in their stances that Jim Langer, the center, gave out, and it was 3 different signals, and they called it red, white, and blue. And based on how the defense was lined up, it was one of those 3.
Yep.
So it was very simple, but it was still direct.
Right. And you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out, I know what the red defense is, I know what the white defense is, I know what the blue defense is, so I know what to respond. And today you got a call that goes through like 14 different plays, and you got to try to remember, okay, on the 3rd count, that's the play we're going with if he called an audible or something like that.
I'm surprised more offsides penalties aren't called today.
Exactly.
Couldn't agree more. Well, hearing like Tom Brady talk about what he looks at when he breaks the huddle, he's like, I have about, 10 seconds, when I'm walking up to assess this and then call it out and change the play. I mean, it's fascinating, everything that's going on. And then getting those signals out. I mean, who was it that said once, it's like, you know whether Walter Payton is running or blocking because whether he puts his mouth guard in. That was his tell, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But it's incredibly complicated. I mean, you need some autonomy out there because you can only practice for so much. And then if the play breaks down, if the gap is filled or the guy gets tripped up or a fumble and has to bounce to the outside, I mean, at some point there has to be an intelligence,
without a doubt.
I think back to the 70s. I'm going to talk about high school ball just real quick. First play is called blue. And then it's 42, and then it's 44, and then it's 46. So you know what you're, what, you know you got the middle play. So that's blue 44, whatever it is, and you run that play. Now, like I said, today you got about 14 different calls at the line. I don't know. I have no clue how they're picking it
up. And how they keep track of it. Yeah.
How do you keep track of something like that?
Well, now you see something that you don't see in the 70s that much. It's that wristband thing that, that has all the plays on it.
Yeah.
How do you not? Hey, Joe, you touched on a little bit, just the people you interviewed. I think what I wanted to know is, who reached out to you? How did you get in touch with Larry Little to write the book? Did he reach out to you based on the previous books you've written, like Willie Lanier, et cetera? Or did you reach out to him? How'd you get in touch with that at first?
Another unique thing. A guy that follows my Facebook page, the NFL in the 1970s,
love it,
is a friend of Larry Little's. And he asked Larry Little, because, other players were getting books written, do you want to have a book written about yourself? And Larry said, yeah. And so he emailed me, he on my Facebook page, and he said, would you be interested in writing a book about Larry Little? And I thought about it, and I said, well, I've never written specifically about an offensive lineman before. And I knew Larry Little of him. I knew what he would accomplish. So I thought, okay, I'm interested. So he gets back and he tells Larry Little this. This guy, his name's David Birch, he emails me Larry Little's phone number. And I call him up and I start interviewing him over the phone. And then I asked him, I said, Are you friends with Joe Green? Do you still keep in contact with Larry Zonka and Bob Greasy? Yeah. Can I interview them? Do you mind if I interview them about you? And he goes, no, not at all. So he gives me their numbers.
Oh, my.
And so, but you got to build up trust with this. A lot of times what I do is I use that NFL in the 1970s book as my ticket. Basically, I mailed that book. I'm like working on a book about the Hail Mary pass. So I mailed that book to Roger Staubach, asking him if I could interview him over the phone. Now, I didn't think he was going to call back, but lo and behold, he did. He called me up. I'm thinking, who do I know in Dallas, Texas? So I answered the phone.
Nailed it.
Yeah. So, that opened that door there. I decided, well, works for Staubach, should work for Pearson, Drew Pearson. So I sent him a copy of that NFL in the 70s book. He calls me up. I'm on the phone with him for almost an hour. He swears he didn't push off, by the way. Anyway.
I love that you just added that. That's awesome.
I'm now it doesn't always work, mind you. None of the Viking players have written back to me yet saying that they want to be interviewed for that book. So and in that case, you have to look up old newspapers and stuff like that to find out what they said at that time.
Right.
Yeah. So that's kind of how I got involved in that.
That's really cool, isn't it? It boils down to put out good vibes, and the world gives it back to you. So, I mean, on your 70s in the NFL in the 70s, you have Mean Joe Green as one of your landing page photos. So you're probably going to have to change that to Larry Little, in honor of the book.
I have one of Joe Green's quotes on the back of the cover of the Larry Little book.
Gotcha.
But I promised him a signed copy as soon as he gets published. Let those two argue about it. I'm not getting in between them. But they're both getting up there in years, so I'm not.
I think in a lot of cases, I get along much better, with the few former NFL players that I know. And I've met over the years. I still stay in contact with several of them. And I think they appreciate being recognized for what they did. And, you know, again, they came from a different time of what the NFL is. The NFL today is big business. It was not this big business in the 70s or 80s, as we both know. You know, all know that.
I got a chance to interview Kyle Davis. Now, I know both of you probably don't even know who that was, but he was the center who centered the ball back to Roger Staubach on the Hail Mary pass.
He was only
in for a couple of plays because the full-time center, John Fitzgerald, was injured.
Yeah.
So he comes in and, you know, he was happy as a clam to be interviewed.
Yeah, nice.
Any good stories about that? I mean, you just rattled off some Hall of Fame names. I mean, like a year ago, Bob and I were trying to get, you know, Larry Zonka, you know, on the show. And we got his manager, and then they went silent on us. I mean, that, you know, that book is opening some doors. I'm thinking about buying that book, putting my phone number in there, and pretending to be you.
Well, hey, as long as I get a finder's fee. You know, I knew that it was going to be helpful, but I also knew that it wasn't always going to be helpful, as evidenced by the fact that no Vikings players have, you know, called me. But it's funny, some of the stuff that I talked to Drew Pearson about with the Hail Mary pass, he didn't even know, and we're talking 50 years. He didn't realize, because he was concentrating on the flight of that ball actually landed and ricocheted off of the ankle of Nate Wright, who was covering him.
Wow.
And it flew right in between his elbow and his hip. And of course, Nate Wright will tell you, and he didn't tell me because he hadn't talked to me yet, but he'll tell you that Drew Pearson pushed off. But if you slow the film down, they both got their feet tangled up with each other,
right,
and both of them were looking away from their feet. They were looking towards the sky. So it wasn't any push-off, but Nate Wright started to fall.
Oh.
If Nate Wright doesn't fall, that pass doesn't get completed. And if Nate Wright doesn't fall exactly where he fell, to the point where his left leg was 2 feet off of the ground, that ball doesn't ricochet into Drew Pearson.
Right.
So when I showed that, I showed close-up photos of that to Drew Pearson, he couldn't believe it. And he said, that's another irony that I've never seen before. It just makes this play live on for so many years, you know.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got a friend who's a huge Cowboys fan who recovered that Drew Pearson ball that he chucked up out of the parking lot.
Did really? Because I'd like to talk to him.
Well, I don't know. Why don't you text me Larry Zonka's number, and then I'll give you his number.
I'm
totally kidding, Joe. No.
Okay. you know, because I talked to Drew Pearson, and he told Harvey Martin, who was his roommate at the time, he said to Harvey the night before the game, if I catch the winning touchdown, you know, in this game, I'm going to throw that ball over the scoreboard. That's exactly what happened. But I always thought he threw it at the scoreboard. I didn't realize that he threw it over it. Yeah. And he goes, "Oh yeah, I was a quarterback in college. I knew I could sling it." So he threw it over the scoreboard. And
Bob, remind me, they found it like a year and a half ago, and Steve ended up buying it and reaching out to Drew, you know, Pearson, to get the, you know, kind of the provenance. You know, this is what the ball looked like. They found it under a station wagon in the parking lot.
You know, Drew Pearson told me that somebody did come up to him at a card show once, and he wanted to show it to him and claiming that it was the ball. And Drew asked him, "Hey, let me hold it." And he wouldn't let Drew hold it. So I don't know, you know. But I'd love to talk to the guy, you know. It's just one of those ironies in that game there's so many things that crazy that happened in that game. I mean, we talk about Fran Tarkenton's father who passed away in the fourth quarter of that game.
Oh, my.
Right.
And his father's name was Dallas Tarkenton.
Yeah.
I mean, really crazy stuff. So I'm currently working on it and, you know, I'm wishing that I had some free time.
Wow. That's great. Joe, we're running out of time. So what I'd like for you to do, if you could let our audience know where they can pick up the new book when it comes out and where they can get your old books too.
The Larry Little book is available right now for pre-sale on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Okay.
And it will be released on October 7th.
Okay.
Also, all of my other books are available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Okay, good. All right. I highly recommend. I mean, I read every one of your books. I really look forward to the Larry Little book. I can only imagine the stuff I will pick up again. And, you know, I love the history of the game of football. I love reading about it. And I do love the obscure facts that we tend to forget about. And Fran Tarkenton's father, I mean, that popped right in my head. I forgot completely about that in the game.
Mm-hmm.
His father died in the fourth quarter. And at the same time, his father's name was Dallas. So
yeah,
I haven't heard that in years. That's it's great information.
Yeah, it's crazy. The game that we're watching tonight, it may provide history that we'll talk about 50 years from now. I won't because I'll be dead, but other people might.
Right. I agree with that. You know, we got to preserve the history of the game. And, you know, we try as much as we can. And Joe, I really appreciate what you do for the hobby and for the history of the game, preserving it. I love your 1970s Facebook page. I don't spend enough time on social media. I can't afford to spend 18 hours of my day on it, which people say I should be on Instagram. I got to check my X site. I got to do my Facebook page. So I can't keep track of everything. So I do try to.
I liked your George Hallis, your Papa Bear post.
Oh, yeah.
About there you go, by the way, Joe.
I'm still trying to get the original words to the Chicago Bears fight song. I know the first two lines. That's it. So
keep your chin up. You'll get it.
Okay.
Joe, thanks for being on. And again, I urge our audience to pick up your new book. And if you don't have your old books, please get them either at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. All right, Joe, we got a couple minutes left. We're going to go in our 2-minute warning and a handoff to you. What'd you pick up on tonight's show?
Oh, I love stories like this. Joe, thank you for being a guest on. The O.J. Simpson book is the only one of yours I've read, but apparently the 1970s in the NFL carries a little more bravado with retired NFL players. So I'll be checking that one out. Thank you for taking a great topic and whittling down on it. Bob and I always enjoy talking to people who that is their passion, is grabbing something and just memorializing it to paper for the rest of us to enjoy. So thank you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you, Joe, and thank you, Bob. It's been my pleasure. You guys take care and enjoy the rest of your football season.
Okay, same here. Thank you,
okay.
Joe.
Yep, bye-bye.
So, Joe, real quick, we are going to go back into next week, hopefully. I got a couple of collectors who will be on the show. I'm trying to work out times, and we're working on the new issue of Gridiron Greats magazine, which will hopefully be out in the beginning of October. And that's about all my updates I got. Great show again, as usual, with Joe Jagorski, our
great guest. When was he on previously? I forget. He's been on before.
2024 with the Buffalo Bills O.J. Simpson book.
That's right.
And prior to that, it was way back in 2020 when we talked about the Willie Lanier book at that time.
Yeah. So I remember asking about how hard it was to, you know, to deep dive on O.J. Simpson. He's like, you know, I was just after the NFL history.
Right. Exactly. And that's what it's all about. We got to preserve the game. And again, I know I'm harsh on today's memorabilia market and card market because I just think there's no collecting going on. And it just frustrates me to say the least. So hopefully that'll turn around. Hopefully the bubble will pop and things will change in the future.
We shall see.
We can have fun with cards again. All right, that's all I have. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine,
what are you waiting for?
Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. Until next week, we will be back, hopefully, with a couple new guests, and we'll see you then. Take care.
Hey there. Welcome to Music Meets Sports, where sports legends meet custom soundtracks and unforgettable stories come to life through music. I'm Sean, the marketing director. Music Meets Sports was created by music producer Ronald Tyke Oliver to bridge generations, educate fans, and celebrate the greatness of both current and former athletes. We craft original songs about heroes in basketball, football, baseball, boxing, and beyond, highlighting their early struggles and personal battles, their faith, character, and drive, their inspiring victories on and off the field. Across genres, hip-hop, R&B, rock, pop, even country, we reintroduce fans to their favorite athletes in a way they've never heard before. From Babe Ruth to Reggie White, from rising WNBA stars to timeless NFL greats, we give legends their flowers in full surround sound. Stream or download our music now on Apple Music, Amazon Music, and Spotify. Visit musicmeetsports.org to explore the catalog, hear new releases, and join the movement that's preserving sports history, one song at a time. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Music Meets Sports. That's sports with a Z. Music Meets Sports. The raw energy of sports, the emotional depth of music.